day. This is Professor Heindelwitz of the Michigan Institute of Statistical Enumeration of Statistical Calculations. A recent, very thorough survey and study has indisputably, irrefutably, and disreputably concluded that you are listening to Guildcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the 64th episode of Guildcast for February 15th, 2007. I'm your host, Sean. This week, there's been a little bit of a change of plans on the topic, as I know last week I mentioned the roundtable episode this time, but there were actually a few snags along the way with that, so I'm hoping to get that episode done by next week for episode 65. So instead of that topic, this show's theme will be A Complete Guide to Worms. That's, of course, the kind you ride in Nightfall, not the kind you dig up in your backyard and eat. First, though, some people who asked to be mentioned this week include Lyle Weatherwind, O Dagger O, Lyrith Swiftblade, Asmodeus Ur, Danoob Schoolbus, Sorrow's Quickshot, Viro Swift Slicer, and Singing Paladin, who says that he'd be willing to help out any new players who may need it. So, let's talk a little bit about last week's episode, episode 63. I just want to talk about that for a second before I get into the news. It seems that, overall, I would say probably 98.5% of the people really love the show. I was getting a lot of PMs last week and the week before that, as well as an overflowing inbox with requests for more shows like it. Of course, there were a few who hated it and said that they're going to stop listening to Guildcast now because I've turned into such a foul-mouthed whatever. But, you know, those people completely missed the point, as well as the 400 disclaimers that I made. So, yeah. The truth is, I never really planned on doing any other shows like that. This was just going to be my one chance to talk like a normal adult human being because of the show's topic. So there's no plans to do any more explicit shows, really. I mean, I might in the future, who knows, but right now there's no plans for it. I don't want that to turn into a gimmick, and I still stand by my previous ideals of keeping the show mainly clean, just not that episode. And guys in the Guildcast guilds, and in the Alliance and everything, this doesn't mean that you can now use explicit language over Guild and Alliance chat. Those rules haven't changed. Thank you. Hey, speaking of the Guildcast Guild, I had some changes to it recently that I wanted to announce on here for anyone who's in the Guild and doesn't go in the forums. What I've done is I've updated the rules a little bit, and I made Guild membership a bit more restrictive, I guess. Now what happens when you fill out an application as a listener, I'm no longer going to just accept anyone and everyone who's a listener. Before, that was restrictive enough at the time, but we've had some problems, and we're to the point where we can just pick and choose a little bit more, basically. So there's now a higher chance that if you submit an application, you may not make it into the guild. And that's basically all I'm saying. Also, previously, there was no activity restriction, so you could potentially be gone for 6 months and still be in the guild. Well, a few weeks ago, I changed that to a 3-month restriction, where I'd kick you out if you reached 3 months in activity, but now I've actually decreased that to 2 months. Of course, if you get kicked out of the guild for this reason, and you come back to Guild Wars later, and you want to be back in the guild, that's no problem. I'll let you back in. You know, everybody needs a break every once in a while. I actually want to do a show topic one day on being a successful guild leader and how to run a guild successfully. But, of course, I'd have to learn that myself first. Kidding. But I do think it would be cool to interview some of the larger, more successful guild leaders and see what makes them tick. So you can probably look for that as a show topic pretty soon. Anyway, on to the big news. I think the biggest news of all time actually happened last week on February 6th. What could possibly be the biggest news of all time? Give up? Well, they added lip-syncing to the Factions and Prophecies cinematics, of course. And in other news, other less important news, I guess, there is a new Celestial tournament starting very soon, and ArenaNet bills it as the largest PvP tournament they've ever hosted. This GVG event offers an extensive list of both real-world and in-game prizes with a total value of over $7,000. In addition, the community at large will be invited to join in the final playoffs via the Zunle Tournament House system. Unfortunately, the registration for this has passed earlier this week, but I think it'll still be an exciting tournament to at least keep an eye on. Also starting this week will be a new in-game holiday event, and this ties in with the Celestial Tournament as a celebration of the Canton New Year, which actually corresponds with the Chinese New Year. So here's what GuildWars.com has to say about it. Each year, Cantons flock to Xingjie Monastery to prepare and partake in a great feast to honor their particular celestial animal who will watch over them during the coming year. This year's animal, the celestial pig, will descend from the heavens to enjoy Canta's culinary delights. If satisfied with the meal, the celestial pig will bestow good luck upon the populace for the coming year. The Canton New Year's Festival event begins at noon Pacific Standard Time on Friday, February 16, 2007, and will run all weekend, ending at noon Pacific Standard Time on Monday, February 19, 2007. On Sunday, February 18th, the celestial pig will drop from the sky into Xingjie Monastery every 3 hours to sample Canton delicacies. The feast culminates in dancing, fireworks, and the showering of the populace with gifts, but only if the celestial enjoys its meal. While the bulk of the Canton New Year's Festival, including the celestial feast, takes place in Xingjie, Cantons living abroad have taken their customs with them as well. So expect Lion's Arch and Commandant to host smaller celebrations, complete with traditional New Year's decorations. But if you want to dance the night away in your festival mask and have the chance to receive a special prize should every course of the Celestial's meal be completed to perfection, you must journey to Xingjie Monastery for the grand finale. In addition to the great feast, look for a variety of festival-themed quests available from some colorful new NPCs, and don't forget to have your fortune read by the fortune teller wandering Xingjie during the festival. If you're feeling up to a trip to the racetrack, you won't want to miss out on the inaugural running of the Roller Beetle races. This new PvP minigame is sure to get your heart and your Roller Beetle racing. Oh, that's corny. So mark your calendars and be sure to come help ring in the new year Canton style. You won't want to miss this brand new Guild Wars event. In other news, PC Gamer Magazine awarded Guild Wars Nightfall its 2006 awards for Best MMO and Best Value. They cited gorgeous, engaging environments populated by some of the coolest and most creative-looking monsters and characters out there. The editors also gave a nod to their favorite game element, the low-level quests, and to the near-unlimited gameplay for the one-time price of the boxed copy. The awards reception for the 2006 1-Up Awards erupted into chants of Guild Wars, Guild Wars, just prior to the announcement of Guild Wars Nightfall as the best online multiplayer game of 2006. 1-Up says, fans of Guild Wars Nightfall loved the multiplayer experience of the game and helped vote it the winner in the online multiplayer category. Plus, they said it has the best podcast out of any MMO out there. Oh, wait. No, it doesn't. I just made that part up. And then on Wednesday, February 14th, ArenaNet dished out a bit of its own Valentine's Day present for all of us. There was a huge new update that I'm guessing is that big update that they usually do before each PvP preview event for the new chapter. But, of course, don't quote me on that. I don't have any inside information on that. I'm just speculating. It would be nice, though, if that new preview event is coming up, though, because the six-month mark for Chapter 4 is only just a little more than 2 months away now. So it's fast approaching. So, as always, I'll put a link in today's show notes for the complete list of changes with this update, but let me just go over a few of the major points, or at least my favorite ones. The skill bar displayed in the Skills and Attributes panel now allows the player to change the order of equipped skills while in a mission or explorable area. The skill bar displayed in the Skills and Attributes panel can be expanded into a set of full descriptions by a new button on the bar itself. This sort by drop list has been removed and replaced by the following iconic drop menus. There's sorting method, which offers all the options the sort by drop list used to offer. And now there's display mode, which offers display as a list, display as small grid, and display as a large grid. The same display and sort options have also been added to skill trainers. So this affects not only the skill panel, but also the skill trainers, and it also affects the skill panel with Signet of Capture as well. Okay, so the next thing is they added an option to the hero control panel that forces heroes to drop the currently carried bundle. This option is mainly useful for forcing ritualist heroes to drop urns created by skills. And you can now log out of the character select screen by hitting the character select button on the logout dialog. This is a change from when you used to have to completely log out. Now you can just log out your character. Challenge missions now track high scores differently and show the top 50 scores. They now track quarterly best scores instead of all-time best scores. They also track scores internationally across all game territories. You can now use miniatures in towns and outposts, but only 20 miniatures can be used at a time per district. And then on a subsequent update, they removed the noises that mini pets make to cut down on the annoyance factor, I'd imagine. Also, some other things they did was the Sunspear title track is no longer maxed at Sunspear Marshal. There's now a new level at 30,000 points, which is considered the legendary Spear Marshal. Then they added a new title track, Sweet Tooth title track, where you'll get one or more points by consuming various sugary foods or drinks. They added 5 Imperial Chefs, who each require collectible drops. Currently, they don't offer the rewards for these items, but I'm sure they will this weekend, probably tomorrow. This update may have added the char bag also, but some people say it was actually added a couple days before. But what the char bag is it seems to be a present to the characters that never leave pre-searing, basically, where ordinary bags can't be obtained. It's only obtainable as a drop from the char bosses across the wall in pre-searing. And what it does is, since regular bags aren't able to be obtained in pre-searing, these act as a substitute for that, where they can hold 10 items each. And also they had the I'm Very Important title, which is now available as the 3rd rank of the maxed titles rank. And finally, they removed the easily accessible demonic chest in the Stygian Vale region of the Domain of Anguish. This was actually something that I saw a few weeks ago. It was pointed out to me by a guildie, who shall remain nameless. And he showed me this. There was basically a really simple run where you could run to a demonic chest, and it would always, well, no, I scratched that. It wouldn't always have a gold item, but it would mostly always have a gold item in there. And there were always really nice skins, and there were usually demonic items. But the only bad thing was the keys, I believe, are 1,200 gold. So it almost wasn't worth it. Now, before I get into the main topic, I had one more thing that I wanted to talk about that's pretty newsworthy, I think. Last week, NCSoft Europe held a winter party for the winners of a contest where people submitted their most convincing reasons for NCSoft Europe to invite them to this party. So a couple of my listeners, Dave and Gwen, were winners in this contest, and they attended the winter party held in Brighton, UK on Saturday, February 3rd. I made a deal with them when I found out that they won, that if they can get me some info from that party, I'd send them some Guildcast t-shirts to throw that Guildcast name out there a little bit more, you know. So they agreed, and I got the shirts out to them just barely in the nick of time for the party. I mean, literally like the day before, I think. And they went to the party, and then they wrote back their reviews of the party, as well as some other notes that were taken with their conversations with Isaiah, Izzy Cartwright, and Martin Kirstein. Izzy is basically the skill balancer for Guild Wars. And Martin Kirstein is self-described as the minion of Alex Weeks, who... Alex Week is the European Gale Grey, I guess you could say. He's in charge of the Guild Wars community relations in Europe. So Dave and Gwen were able to sit down and talk to Izzy, and I'll go over some of the things they wrote down in their notes to me. They originally actually wanted to record this themselves, but it's kind of funny. They realized just how difficult it is to record something and sound, you know, halfway presentable and then edit it also for content. So they... After a little while, they basically said, here, Sean, here's the notes. This is harder than we thought. Here, can you read this on the show? So, you know, I told them that's no problem at all. I understand. I completely understand, believe me. So let me just read a little bit from their notes. Since his specialty is skill balancing, most of what Izzy said pertained to skill balancing, of course. For example, recently, the Ritualist got some major skill balancing, and Izzy says that this was important because most players... were not able to use a diverse line of attributes, which is why they moved Bloodsong and, you know, things like that. Also, he mentions a little on what he pays attention to when deciding what gets balanced and what doesn't. He uses mainly community feedback and some number crunching to see what skills are actually being used. He says his favorite way to check with PvP is with the 8v8, which might be why they brought that back. Now, I've heard before that they can do this to tell what's being used the most, which skills are actually being used the most, where they have like a stats kind of a back-end thing where they do, which is also one of the main methods that they use for determining what might be exploited, like with Spirit Bond. He also says a change to the NPC AI is planned very soon, since the ladder system was recently fixed. Also, ArenaNet wants to encourage offensive strategies instead of the defensive ones that you see in PvP now, where it's basically like whoever attacks first loses. They want to make sure that they can somehow balance it to change that. Oh, and here's a good one. He hinted that our favorite little pre-searing monkette Gwen will indeed be used in the future of Guild Wars. But of course, there's no more details on that. And here's some other things that he mentioned that ArenaNet wants to fix, but they don't really have a plan of action in place yet. One of them is how to get to core areas like the Underworld with a high cost system instead of a complete lockout when your region doesn't have favor. So that might be something like, you know, you pay a little bit more money if your region doesn't have favor, but you can still get down to the Underworld. I think this will really help out Americans because it sure seems like Europe has favor most of the time anyway. And then he says there are some plans to incorporate real-world cash prizes for the 1v1 hero battles very soon. He also says hero pet naming will not happen, ever. And although hero pet changing may happen, but he says don't hold your breath. The guild systems and friends list both have a number of changes in store for the future. And finally, he says guild storage isn't something that's likely in the future. And he explains why. He says because of the way that Guild Wars is spread over so many servers, it would allow for potential duplicates when transferring data. So before things like guild storage and a few other issues with the same problem are to actually become a reality, the security aspect needs to be figured out. So there you have it. I wanted to thank Dave and Gwen for their notes on this party, and in the show notes for today, I'm going to post a picture or two that were actually taken from that party. And one of them has Dave in his Guildcast t-shirt. It's pretty exciting. So let's talk about worms. If you have Nightfall and you've made it to the Desolation area, then you'll be familiar with the rideable worms. Now, I don't see this as a spoiler, because even in the previews of Nightfall, before it even came out, there were interviews where people from ArenaNet, like Jeff Strain, I believe was one of them, mentioned that the rideable worms were a feature of Nightfall. So I'm going to use this segment to talk more about them, their uses, their history, their skills, and more. The desert worms, as we've known them before, were always a formidable enemy, not only popping up in the explorable crystal desert of Tyria, but they also took the form of siege worms in the desert missions, and even proved a nuisance as frost worms in the areas outside of Beacon's Perch on the way to Drachner's Forge. But with the introduction of Nightfall, we find a whole new kind of worm, the kind that can roam the sulfurous wastelands of the Desolation. Alonians know them by their more formal name, the Janundu. According to historians, the undead lord Palawa Jako commanded these worms to patrol his kingdom, but the Janundu's inability to tunnel through solid rock limited their usefulness. Myths tell of great heroes using Janundu to travel across the wastelands, covering vast distances safe from sulfuric clouds. More recent accounts describe devastating wails and thunderous attacks that shake the very earth and topple buildings in their wake. According to legend, Janundu society is developed enough that they act in service to a single matriarch, or queen mother, a subterranean monstrosity called Ijundu. Lurking below, Queen Ijundu patiently waits for foolish surface dwellers who would dare to cross her apocalyptic domain. As long as wind shifts the desert sands, some say she will lie beneath it waiting. You can find the Janundu in 7 areas of Nightfall currently. There's Crystal Overlook, Dynastic Tombs, the Gate of Desolation Mission, Jocko's Domain, the Alkali Pan, the Shattered Ravines, and the Sulphurous Wastes. Now let's talk about the many uses of the worms and some helpful tips on using them most effectively. After you do the Gates of Desolation mission, where you actually tame the worms enough to make them rideable throughout the rest of the Desolation, you can then enter any Janundu by using a worm spore. You'll see these right outside of the towns and outposts in the Desolation. They're basically like little rivets in the sand with a few worms circling around them. You can just see that, like, the tops of their heads coming out of the sand just a little bit. And you can also tell what they are, of course, by the word worm spore in bright yellow letters. When you summon a Janundu, it will have 3,000 health and 60 energy regardless of the level, profession, or equipment of the character controlling it. Janundu are known to have exactly 20 AL against earth damage. They are also known to have low AL against most or all types of damage, however the exact values are unknown. The Janundu has the same energy recovery of the character inside. Equipped items with energy regeneration -1 will affect the Janundu as well. Only bonus modifiers like runes, weapon modifiers, weapon upgrades, insignias, things like that will affect the maximum health and energy, not the base bonuses such as base energy bonuses on staffs and focus items, or base energy bonuses on armor. And alternating between different weapon sets or re-equipping an armor piece that has a rune applied to it actually does affect the maximum health and energy of the worm. Since they give constant health and armor, worms make a great way to power level your new, lower level heroes. A Janundu's regular attacks do a flat amount of armor ignoring damage, dependent on the weapon type, actually. Like swords, hammers, and axes inflict 55 damage per hit, just a flat rate. Daggers inflict 40 damage per hit with a chance to double strike. Scythes inflict 35 damage per hit and can hit one adjacent secondary target. Bows inflict 40 damage per hit and have a ranged attack, and the range varies with the bow type, of course. Spears inflict 55 damage per hit and have a ranged attack as well. And wands and staves inflict 40 damage per hit and have a ranged attack. So it seems like, according to this, up close you'd be better off using a sword, hammer, or axe from within the worm, and from far away you'd be better off using a spear, because they both do 55 damage. Now the actual damage type of the Janundu's weapon is the same as the damage type of the weapon the character is holding, like cold damage or shadow damage, or, you know, fire damage, anything like that. It that does stay. If you wield a smiting rod or a smiting staff, that will actually allow your Janundu to do double damage against undead for its normal attacks, like any normal smiting damage would do. When controlling a Janundu, the character's primary attribute is reduced to 0. You can actually press K, and you see in the attributes menu that the primary will be just a big fat red 0. Death penalty does not affect the worm, but it does still accumulate, and it will affect the character inside once the character leaves the worm. Keep this in mind, especially if you have to encounter more enemies from the point between where you actually leave the worm to the next zone area. So, like, if you exit your worm and then you have to get to the next city, but in between there's a bunch of Marganites that you have to fight, just keep in mind, you know, that you're still going to have that DP that you had from within the worm. Now, for some other tips on the Jinundu, of course, they are immune to the sulfurous haze environment effect, and they cannot tunnel through rocky terrain. If you try to do so, it will cause the worm to release the character controlling it, similar to as if you use the Leave Jinundu skill. And by release, of course, I mean they'll puke you out onto the rocks. The skill Jinundu Smash, which I'll actually talk more about later, can be used to knock down certain pillars to create bridges. Some skills active on the player, like enchantments, stances, hexes, and forms, are lost when entering or leaving a Jinundu. But echoes will persist until they expire, but of course they can't be reapplied as there's no shouts in the Jinundu skill set. The skill Jinundu Tunnel will remain active when a character leaves a worm. When a player has left a Jinundu, all skills are reset, including the Resurrection Signet. Pets will die when entering a Jinundu in explorable areas. When the owner of the pet exits the worm, their pet will reappear beside them alive. Only during the Gate of Desolation mission will the pet enter its own Jinundu, which is kind of funny. Pets do not use any of the Jinundu skills, though. And if the pet dies while in the Jinundu, Jinundu Wail, which is the Resurrection Signet type spell that I'll talk about in a minute, that will actually not resurrect the pet in its own Jinundu during that mission. But interestingly enough, pets gain experience for the monsters defeated by their Jinundu riding owners. Minions, on the other hand, are not killed when the characters enter a Jinundu. Jinundu controlled by henchmen keep a fairly large distance between you and each other while stationary. This can cause problems when using a worm spore near rocky terrain, because if henchmen might be standing on sand before entering the worm, they may move towards the rocky terrain once they're inside, and then they'll be released. So take a moment to check all of your henchmen and make sure they're all inside their worms before you move out into the sulfurous haze. This has actually become a pretty big problem. Like, after exiting the sulfurous haze, or after traveling for a significant length of time outside of the sulfurous haze in the sandy neutral area between the sulfurous waste and the rocky terrain, you'll find that sometimes henchmen will often exit their worms for just no reason at all, and it's pretty annoying. So for best results, enter the worms immediately before entering sulfurous haze and don't really, you know, linger around too long. Because, you know, this pretty much drives me insane, because sometimes they just exit their worm, and what you have to do is you have to actually exit your own worm, then everybody else in the party has to exit their worm, and then you have to re-enter the worms so that the henchmen will re-enter their worms. I would definitely call this a bug, but it's just pretty much a pain in the butt all around.
Hey all, this is Lady Sinea bringing you the word on the street. Something in this game has been changing. The change has been gradual, so I hadn't really noticed it while it was happening. But when I look at it now in retrospect, it all seems so obvious. Back on episode 61, we had a listener who wrote in and asked us to discuss the antisocial aspect that some people feel is taking over due to most people going henchway or hero way in both PvP and PvE. And we talked about that a little bit. At the time, I kind of just played it off and said, you know, some people just like to play by themselves, and sometimes pickup groups are too annoying to deal with, and things like that. But, you know, it is true. This change has been so gradual that I hadn't really seen it while it was happening, but the signs have all been there. I've been trying to put my finger on exactly what it is that's causing it, but I'm sure that it's not just one thing. All I do know for certain is that the game I'm playing right now is not the same game that I was playing 12 months ago. So, let's see if we can figure out at least some of it. Number one, of course, is that this game has gotten huge, and it's only going to get bigger. 1 year ago, we were a small and tight community, with one continent and a few PvP areas. Mere months and two new chapters later, we now have three PvE continents, all of the original PvP areas, as well as Fort Aspenwood, Jade Quarry, Alliance Battles, Hero Battles, and I'm sure I'm leaving something else out, but I do know that there are a lot more people being introduced to Guild Wars every day, but also there are some that have dropped off and don't play anymore, so when you look at the rate of expansion of the player base, compared with the rate of expansion of the game, they just aren't proportional. That's why we run into things like, it seems like no one needs to do the mission that you're currently stuck on, or whatever. Everyone is so spread apart that it seems like there are a lot less people. A year ago, there weren't this many places that you could go and just lose yourself alone. There weren't too many places to go, so it was really easy to gather a bunch of friends in one area and all hang out somewhere. Literally running into someone in-game was quite common. I remember I was hanging out with a friend of mine in Omnoon Oasis one time, and I was just talking and doing emotes and stuff like that. And Sean happened to be there and he saw me, so he whispered me and was like, "Hey, I know that name." This was back in, like, January of last year, before I was on Guildcast and before Factions had come out. And, that was actually the first time I'd ever seen Sean in-game, and it was one of those times when I was on really late and he popped online for a couple minutes before going to work. But nowadays, with all the space that there is in this game, you can burrow in pretty much anywhere and never talk to another person. I'm not saying that ArenaNet should stop developing games, but anyone can see that adding this much new landmass every 6 months is having a huge impact upon the Guild Wars community. What's the solution without adding a monthly fee? I don't know. All I know is that the player base is not expanding fast enough to keep up with the rapid growth of the Guild Wars world, and I fear that that alone is going to be the downfall of this game if that trend keeps up. Another aspect of this antisocial trend is heroes and henchmen. It's always been possible to go through pretty much the entire game using only henchmen. My typical playing style, though, pretty much the entire time that I've played this game, was to hench quests and pug missions. The thing I love most about games like Guild Wars is the multiplayer aspect of it. I have never tried to play it as a solo game. I don't even like solo farming. Unless I'm having a bad day and don't want to talk to anyone and just want to go kill stuff by myself, I usually want to interact with other people. I have met some great people in pugs. I've got friends who are kind of surprised that I know so many people, and it was simply because I joined a lot of pugs all the time, whether it was for missions or for farming or whatever. I met one of my officers in a pug. I, unfortunately, met Loudon in a pug. However, with the arrival of heroes, it's really easy to not join any pugs at all. Nightfall was the first chapter where I broke my habit of pugging missions. What I did instead was I would first attempt to hero hench the mission, and if I failed or didn't know how to complete the bonus or something, I would look around for a pug. This is a big change from my old playstyle. Me, the one who's always been a big advocate for allowing pugs to join our group, or who doesn't mind joining pugs for things, I totally changed my playstyle in Nightfall. This was not intentional, believe me. And honestly, when I was going through Chapter 3, everyone else was too, so it's not like there was a lack of people in the towns. Something just started gradually changing. Also, I know that there were times that I didn't want to party with multiple people because I wanted to give my heroes the opportunity to level. I know, how stupid is that? Choosing the hero over a real player just because I wanted to level the hero. Don't get me wrong, I love heroes. I used to love outfitting my mercs in Diablo 2, and now I do the same thing for my heroes in Guild Wars. And although it's often much easier to get something done by grabbing a hero for something instead of looking for a pug, it does contribute to this antisocial trend. I know it's not just me either. I often see people in towns with a full party or, like, a near full party, and when you click on them to invite them, you see that it's just them and heroes and henchies. And then there are, of course, the people who aren't in a group who are looking for one, and unfortunately, a lot of times, the people who are hero henching things are the good players who are self-sufficient and who know what they're doing. Quite often, the people who are looking for a pug are the ones who are inexperienced and don't know how to play very well yet. This makes pugging even more discouraging than ever. I usually don't mind pugging. Really, I don't. I was doing the D'Alessio Seaboard mission on my Mesmer a little while ago, and I jumped into a pug for it. I could quite easily have done the mission by myself, but there's a group forming, so I joined it. They said that they were doing the mission and the bonus, so I said, that's cool, that's what I want. And a couple people said that they didn't know where the bonus was, but I knew, so I guided them, and we went and saved Benji, and I picked up the pot thingy because I could still cast while holding it, and during the next battle, our two warriors went off into some random direction, but I wasn't really too worried about it because I and the other players there were doing just fine defending Dorian by ourselves. And when that was done, I was like, okay, cool, follow me, and we'll go put this thing on the altar. But then the final cutscene activated, and the mission ended. So I was so pissed because we had that bonus in the bag. Plus, the really annoying thing is that you have to do practically the entire mission over again just to do the bonus. But failing the bonus was not the thing that upset me the most. In fact, teaching newbies how to do stuff doesn't bother me at all. The thing that pissed me off was that those two players knew exactly what they were doing when they ran off ahead and activated that final cutscene, when they knew we were supposed to be doing the bonus. So, needless to say, I told them off with colorful language and then went back to D'Alessio to go hench the damn thing by myself. One of the other people from the group followed me and asked if he could come along since he had never done it before, so I said sure and we did the bonus with my heroes and henchies. But it's like, sometimes I just get so fed up with really rude people that I don't want to pug at all, and I'll just do the thing by myself because I know it'll be easier. Unfortunately, this also contributes to leading me off down that antisocial road. I join pugs in alliance battles all the time, and it's a rare treat when you actually find a group where the people all stick together instead of running off into some random directions by themselves. Sometimes I'll look to see if there's a group of three guildies, because they're often more coordinated. But more often than not, there's no real interaction with other people, other than some screaming at others to cap, and the usual taunts of the Suxons or the Cursucks, but I wouldn't really call that human interaction. I know that ArenaNet is trying. They're trying to keep things exciting and interesting for us. That's why they started making all these special events all the time. They knew that we loved stuff like Halloween and Winter's Day, so I guess they figured, hey, let's have more events. Well, wake up call, these every weekend events are just not special anymore. Sure, there have been a few that piqued some players' interest and gotten them to try new things, but the majority of these events are simply an increased reward potential for 72 hours, or however long it is. Yes, I loved the double faction AB weekend. I would have loved the recent double XP elite capping weekend, because I wanted to get some more experience on my LE, but sadly that was the same weekend that I left on vacation, so I missed it. And, having double faction in random arenas or team arenas might have gotten more people to try those out. And opening up the Canthan elite missions to everyone, that was a cool opportunity to try your hand at those and see if you liked them. But you know, all the others, double drops of something or another in such and such area, to me, it all just looks like an artificial reason to spend more time in some area of the game. Also, last year it was very apparent that a lot of the special weekends were only in the newest continent. Double chest drops in Cantha meant go buy and play factions. 3x greens in Alona meant go buy and play Nightfall. People who were on the fence and didn't really know if they wanted to buy the new chapter or not might have gone and bought it as a result of one of those events if they so fancied. A lot of new players actually only own factions or Nightfall now and have been asking which chapter they should buy next. Hey, ArenaNet, do some special weekend events in Tyria. You've got new players who might need an incentive to buy prophecies, or what I like to call Guild Wars. As one of my officers has said, ANET does need to take a realistic pulse on their player base and make design and development decisions based on that. So, yes, of course, everything is moving at a fast pace in development, so I can see that having events and then getting feedback from the players can be very helpful. I'm not blaming ArenaNet. I know that they're trying their best to continue to generate interest in their product and get people to buy it. I've worked in small business my whole life, and I know what it's like to have to pay your staff and forego your own paycheck because you didn't turn a profit. It's really quite ingenious how they've set it up that they can release new games so quickly as a solution to generate more income, but unfortunately, if things keep up the way they are, we might not be playing Guild Wars anymore a couple chapters down the line. These special weekends, though, I don't know if they're using them for research to see where people are playing or what, but one thing I thought was really bizarre was the HA weekend. They decreased the party size to 6 and waited to see what kind of feedback they got. Apparently, there were a bunch of new people who got to try it and said that they liked it, and later, an HA party became permanently 6-man. Now, I'm not a Heroes Ascent person myself, but from everything that I've heard on the street, it seems that newcomers either liked it or were indifferent, and longtime HAers were livid. Why would ArenaNet change something that has been so integral to the game for so long? For a year and a half, HA had always been 8v8. Did they just want to make it so that each type of PvP had a different party size, or what? Seriously, it's like almost sacrilegious to change something that has been there for so long from day one. And I'm not even a big PvP-er, and it baffled me. Actually, I didn't even realize that it bothered me until this past weekend. As you know, the HA party size was increased to 8, and suddenly I had the urge to go play some real HA like I used to in an old guild of mine. So this weekend, when my alliance needed some people to join their group, I was so there. I hope that ArenaNet is using this event to look at how people respond to it being restored to 8v8. And listen to me, I said restored, but that's like what it is. It should go back to the way it was, to the way it's always been. You know, someone one time, I think it was after I complained about something about Nightfall, they said, "You know, Sanaa, you're just afraid of change." You know, whether that is true or not is not the issue. All I know is that when something works, you don't mess with it. When you find that perfect formula, run with it and don't stop. Don't try to rearrange everything when all the gears and cogs are all lined up and all fit perfectly already. Unfortunately, I have friends that have left and are playing other games these days. I have guildies who play the new chapters when they come out, and they get bored and then they disappear for a couple of months and until the new chapter arrives, and then they all come back. I actually have a couple of guildies who don't even play Guild Wars practically at all anymore, but they still pop in and say hi and catch up on how everyone is doing. They just come online to socialize. I still play regularly, but I really feel that it's not for the gameplay anymore. Sure, I help people with missions and things like that, but really, a lot of times, I'm just chatting too. Sometimes I'll log on, be standing in my guild hall talking to people, and before I know it, I'm getting the 1-hour warning, and I realize I've been standing in that one spot for an entire hour doing nothing. The weekends are nice because I usually get to see a lot more people, because I can play during the day, and we'll jump on TeamSpeak and mess around and do missions or AB or whatever, and I really like that because why do we play multiplayer games anyway? It's to play with other people, of course. Sadly, though, I know that I play with my friends much less now than I used to. It now seems like a huge treat to get a guild group together for FOW or something, whereas we used to do that all the time. How did we start moving from a wonderfully social game to this single-player mindset? I didn't do it intentionally, I know that for sure, but even I've fallen prey to it. I've got some friends that I've had on my friends list for a long time. A couple of them, I used to farm with them in Sorrow's Furnace or Tombs, and then later in the Canton areas, and we used to hang out together a lot, but we hardly even talk anymore. I always see them online, but I don't say hi or anything. I don't know why, maybe I feel like I'm bothering them since I haven't talked to them in so long. But the other day, one of them whispered me, and I was really quite glad to talk with him. He's one of my buddies who actually doesn't know that I record this silly little segment for this podcast here. Actually, our very first conversation show back on episode 21, it was pretty funny. Sean and I were trying to use Google Talk, and that wasn't working, and we were trying to come up with some other solution, and I said, you know, I think I can find us a TeamSpeak server to record on. So, this friend of mine that I'm talking about, right? So I jump on his TS and say, hey, do you mind if I and a friend of mine use one of your channels to do some recording? And he's like, recording? But he checked and said it was all right, so we used that to record our very first conversation show. And Sean said in the intro of that show that he didn't catch the name of whoever server it was that we used, but he wanted to thank them. Well, I think it was their guild server at the time, but anyway, his name is River. So this is 40-odd episodes late, but thanks for getting us permission to record that show there, buddy. And he doesn't listen to Guildcast, so he'll never hear that, but anyway, never mind that. But back to what I was saying. I hadn't spoken to him in a long time, and we were just talking about how far apart most of us have grown from each other when we used to be so tight. And it really got me thinking. I see people on my friends list all the time who I used to farm with and whatnot, but I don't talk to them anymore. When I see them online, I'm gonna just start saying hi to them. Just to say hi, even if nothing else. How else are we gonna keep in touch? I mean, for crying out loud, I realized I hadn't even talked to Junkmaster in I don't know how long before we did a couple of missions together this past weekend. So that's my new resolution to try to fight this antisocial trend that this game is taking. I am going to make it a point to keep talking to my friends and not let those friendships die out of neglect. Because honestly, when it comes down to it, it's the people that really make this game worthwhile. This has been Lady Sinea bringing you The Word on the Street.
You may have noticed, when your character is inside of a worm, the skill bar completely changes to their skills. This only makes sense since you're inside of the creature, not really able to do anything but lay in its huge, gross, slimy mouth and close your eyes and hope for the best. So let's go over these new worm skills in this Skills and Build segment. First off, let's establish that the Junundu skills will replace the skill bar of the character inside, except for Signets of Capture. The Signets of Capture will still be usable inside the worm. When capturing a skill while riding a Junundu, the newly captured skill will be replaced by the corresponding Junundu skill. As a result, players cannot use any other skills other than the Junundu skills while riding in a Junundu. How many times can I say Junundu in this episode? And make sure that you don't place your Signet of Capture in skill slot number 7. Because if you do, when you enter the Junundu, the Signet of Capture will remain unusable, but will actually cover the slot that the skill that's actually supposed to be in slot number 7, which is Junundu Whale, which is your heal. So check your skill bar the first time you enter the Junundu to see if there are any other skills covered that you want to be able to use also. And if they are, then of course you zone back to the outpost and you adjust your build. So let's go over these skills now. Each skill will be the same for every slot of every character except slots 4 and 6, which will change according to the progression in the game and, pretty much randomness, which I'll explain in a second. Okay, so slot number 1, you have Junundu Strike. This is explained as target touched foe is struck for 150 piercing damage. You gain 75 health. Pretty straightforward attack. In slot number 2, there's Junundu Smash. All adjacent foes are struck for 250 damage and knocked down for 4 seconds. This one uses adrenaline, so it's only available after you build up, the adrenaline during battle. Slot number 3 has Junundu Bite. Target touched foe is struck for 375 piercing damage. If you strike a knocked down foe, you gain 500 health. Now take this last part into consideration to use it immediately after Junundu Smash. But I'll talk a little bit more about a good strategy for all this in a minute. Now in slot number 4, you'll start out with an elite slot, but it will say Unknown Junundu Ability. This skill does absolutely nothing and is only used as a placeholder for when you're actually able to acquire the actual Junundu Elite skill known as Junundu Siege, which you'll get a little bit later on. In the quest's name is Horde of Darkness, I believe, and you get that from the Bone Palace. And what this new elite skill does is it actually spits a projectile at the target foe, and it strikes for 400 earth damage and knocks down target foe if it hits. This skill cannot be used on nearby foes, and it won't really warn you of that, so be aware of that. There's no error message, or there's none of that spell-canceling clicking sound that you hear with other skills if they fail. It'll just simply not work at all if your foe is too close. I usually use this one as my initial attack since it can be used from just outside of the enemy's aggro range. I just really wished it worked on adjacent foes also, like the regular worm siege that you see in the Crystal Desert. But, it only affects one foe at a time. So then in number 5, we have Junundu Tunnel. For 10 seconds, you move 66% faster. This skill ends if you use a skill. And when this skill ends, all adjacent foes are knocked down for 3 seconds. So actually, you can use this skill to run up, or slither up, or whatever, to your foes very quickly, and then you can use Jinundu Bite, which will effectively knock down all adjacent foes because you're using a skill, and it'll give you 500 health in the process. Okay, so slot number 6, we have one skill that actually turns into three other skills, making this the only real true variable in the skill bar. It starts out as Jinundu Feast, where you exploit one adjacent corpse, and then once you use it, Jinundu Feast turns into either Choking Breath, Blinding Breath, or Burning Breath for 30 seconds. So, let's go over each of these, shall we? Okay, first we have Choking Breath. Target foe and all adjacent foes are interrupted. Any interrupted foe who is casting a spell is dazed for 15 seconds. Then we have Blinding Breath. All adjacent foes are struck for 400 damage and are blinded for 15 seconds. And then we have Burning Breath. Spit a burning projectile at target foe that strikes for 250 fire damage and sets that foe on fire for 5 seconds, if it hits. This skill cannot be used on nearby foes. So this is actually a good alternative to Jinundu Strike, the Elite, if you don't have that one yet. And then in number 7, we have the best healing skill in the Worms lineup, and that's the Jinundu Wail. What it does is it resurrects all dead Jinundu within earshot. And if there are no enemies within earshot, you gain 500 experience for each Jinundu in range. This will not only bring back your health bar to full, especially if you have party members around you, but it will also resurrect the fallen teammates with full health as well. And then finally, in slot number 8, we have Leave Jinundu, where the Jinundu basically releases you from its jaws in a slimy, sticky, gooey, puking mess.
This is Jenna, and I'm coming to you less than live. And today I have worms. Actually, I have to confess, I don't really like the worms. When I was starting out, worms were those things in the Crystal Desert that jumped out at you randomly and attacked you and then burrowed back under the ground. And you had to wait around for them because if you moved on, they would just be there with other enemies and it would be a big mess and it took a long time. Sean calls them drama queens, and I think he's right, because let's face it, they jump out of the ground, they go, "Arr, I'm a worm, and I'm attacking you, and I'm big and strong, ooh, you hurt me, I'm going back down," and they come back up, "Arr, I'm a worm, and I'm attacking you, and oh, you hurt me, I'm going back down." So basically, they're in it for the attention, and that's never attractive. So, you know, then you move on to Nightfall, and now you can be the worms, and, you know, good idea, but I tried that challenge mission where you're a worm all by yourself to get the superhero armor. And I did everything Guild Wiki told me to do, and I worked at it for hours, and nothing dropped for me. So, you know, I ended up not getting – one of my guildies got me – guild members got me one piece of armor for Zed. But that just made me want it even more, and I couldn't ask him to get it for me. You work so hard at it. So, and if it doesn't look good – it's not good. That's Jenna's philosophy. So I wanted this armor. I can't just go buy it. Now I'm frustrated with the worms because they're keeping me from pretty armor. But worms is what the show's about, so that's what we're going to talk about. So I racked my brain to think of some stuff about worms. Well, first of all, you guys that like to farm, I don't know why you're not out there worming it up. I go out in these worms, I make a ton of money. So, you know, get out there and do that. What else? Well, think about it. You're being swallowed by a worm. That's disgusting. It's almost, or maybe more disgusting, than wading through the raw sewage in Cantha, which everybody knows is Jenna's favorite pet peeve slash greatest idea that ArenaNet ever had. I want to know who got a raise for that idea, because, whew. What else? Oh, and I thought of a joke for the worms. Here's how it would go. In Mexico, you swallow worm. In Soviet Alona, worm swallows you. Yeah, that's Yakov Smirnov joke. He wasn't funny, so probably me imitating him isn't funny. And you'd have to know that in tequila you swallow the worm. But anyway, moving on. So then my thoughts are about how does this work, controlling these worms? You know, what's the nature of the symbiotic relationship between character and worm? And don't say it's all magic, because that's just a cop-out. Here's my theory. You're in the worm, you're in the belly or the throat, you're walking around, the worm's bigger than you, so you're walking around, you know, like you're in, you know, belly of the whale kind of thing. I figure that you're in there and you have to push and step on and punch and otherwise manipulate organs and innards to make the worm use its skills that you see on the skill bar. So, you know, you're basically in there like one of those dancing machine games where, you know, you see the instructions on the screen and then you have to jump from, you know, point to point, pad to pad, and do it all right. So it's sort of like that. Now, you have those two skills at 1 and 3 that are the easy attacks, right? So you spam those until you build up the skill in slot 2 so you can use skill in slot 2. Then you got the tunneling skill that makes you go fast, and then you have the skill that gets you actually out of the worm. Those are your basics. Those are the ones I use all the time. So what I'm going to do is take you through the thought process of my paragon. He's the one that got through Nightfall first. We're going to go through Osric's thought process when he's in this worm. He's like, okay, I'm in a worm. I'm going through the desert. Marganites. I got to fight them. Okay. If I hit this kidney. Ooh. Okay. That attacks. Okay. If I hit this other kidney. Oh. Okay. That's a different attack. Okay. All right. Here we go. Kidney. Spleen. If I hit these kidneys, and then I hit the spleen. Okay. Kidney. Spleen. All right, I killed this Marganite. Oh, that's where I'm going. I got to get over there. If I go fast, maybe I could avoid these guys. Maybe I squeeze the adrenal gland. I'll go right. Oh, wait. Oh, they're here. Okay. Kidney. Spleen. All right, let's make a run for it. Squeeze the adrenal gland. Oh, yeah. We're cooking with gas. We're moving. Okay. Oh, kidney. Spleen. All right. Oh, I'm here. Oh, great. I got to get out of the worm, though. How do I do that? Oh, maybe if I tickle the uvula, it'll throw up. And, yeah, that's gross, but I'll be out of the worm. So that's good. So tickle the uvula. Oh, it's a girl worm. That's a joke from Monster House. So anyway, you see where I'm coming from. That's what your characters are thinking. And that's all I got.
Well, it's been a while since I've done a farm report segment on Guildcast, and I think this is a great opportunity to bring it back. Farming with worms is one of the easiest things you can do. As I mentioned earlier, you can power level your new lower level heroes while in the worms. Just make sure you set them on aggressive instead of passive, especially when you're playing the monks or something, because it doesn't really matter if they're a caster or whatever, and they're usually set on passive, because they're just in giant worms now anyway, and you want them in the fight. So I tend to use this a lot to farm group XP, and in the process get some really great drops. Now, since the Janundu's build is the same for every character, there's no real secret skill set or anything to contend with, so that just leaves technique and location for farming. Since I just went over the skills with you, and you can see how extremely basic the build can be, it's not hard to figure out that you do basically three things. You cause massive damage, you cause knockdown, and then you heal yourself. Pretty much anyone can do it. The technique I usually use is I first throw down a siege to get their attention and bring the first target about 2/3 down on health. Then since that was my first target, then the heroes and henchies will be attacking him also. And of course there's that little bit of delay between when you actually attack and when the heroes and henchies actually attack. But they'll pretty much take him down within seconds after that. So then I'll switch to another target after that first siege, and then I'll use Janundu Tunnel to just fly up on him, and then I'll use Janundu Bite to knock everything down around me, cause 375 damage, and heal myself. Because it's pretty much inevitable that while I was running up to get to the enemies, they probably cause some damage to me. So this is actually a good way to heal that damage back up. And then I'll use Janundu Feast after that. But, you know, I've found that I usually have problems with this since the Hero Henchy AI is so good at exploiting corpses that there's hardly ever any corpses left for me to use Janundu Feast. So most of the times I'll skip this. even though there is, it's really potentially a great skill, especially when it changes over to one of the breath skills afterwards. And then what I'll do is I'll build up adrenaline with the number one slot, Jinundu Strike, and then once I have enough adrenaline, which doesn't take really that long, I'll use Jinundu Smash, and then I'll use Jinundu Bite again to finish the last one off and heal myself. And then when they're all dead, I'll use Jinundu Whale to heal myself, and then basically we're off to the next group to do it again. Now, as for some great farming locations, there's actually quite a bit, and there's some good areas where you can pick your favorite. But the one that sticks in my mind the most is that monolith temple in the sulfurous wastes. What'll happen is you'll encounter a large group of graven monoliths, which are really easy to kill, and they can rack up some nice experience and gold drops. Also in this temple is one of those treasure chests that I mentioned in a previous episode, so that's like an extra bonus. Now this temple is located in the southwesternmost area of the sulfurous wastes. The worst part about this, though, is there's no ghostly priest in the whole zone that will give you the Lightbringer or experience bonuses for monoliths. I could have sworn there used to be one when Nightfall first came out, but I don't know, I might have just been dreaming that or something. Also, you want to make sure that you save any inscribed shard drops from these monoliths, because you'll need 10 of them for a quest called Sticks and Stones. Or, of course, you can save those inscribed shards for the lazy people who don't want to, you know, go out and farm for themselves. You could probably go in the Bone Palace and sell those. So what you'll need to do to get the most from this temple is you do the quest Temple of the Monoliths, where you basically you go up to the temple. You don't even have to go in. Of course, you can if you want to, but you don't even have to go in. You just go up to it, and then you go back and report what you've seen, basically that there's a bunch of monoliths in here. And then this will open up the next quest after that called A Show of Force. Now, when you go to the temple during this quest, there will be some monolith shrines that are inside of the temple itself, and you'll need to destroy each one, which will actually release more monoliths. And what you do is you do one of these at a time, and make sure that you control your henchies and heroes so that they don't just randomly open up any more of these, which I don't think they actually will, but it's very important to have control over which ones you open, and then clear out all the monoliths, and then go to the next one and open that one. You also fight some Marganites in there as well, so you might want to go to the appropriate ghostly priest beforehand to get that Lightbringer bounty. He's up in the northwestern corner, which is actually on your way down to the temple, so it's a pretty good deal. Anyway, to get the most from this temple area, don't finish off the last shrine. Keep that one intact. And then you warp back, and you just do this all over again. Because what will happen is if you destroy that last monolith shrine, the quest will end, and next time you go in there, there won't be nearly as many creatures inside. So this is a good method of killing a whole lot of very easy enemies for their drops and the experience. Now, of course, there's other areas around the Desolation, and many of the undead and the Marganites travel in fairly large groups. So when you're in a worm, it's so much easier to kill these groups. Just make sure that you get the Lightbringer bounties for each creature beforehand to make it more worth your while if you're strictly XP farming. There are also some bosses in the Desolation area that are easily farmable with worms. And in the 7 areas that you can take the worms, there are potentially 21 different unique green items that I've counted that can be dropped by bosses. So this is a great area and a great method with the worms to farm green items. So that'll do it for another episode of Guildcast. I hope you all learned something here today about worms. The next episode will be the roundtable episode that I mentioned last week, where 8 of us got together to do the Gyala Hatchery mission. The audio and video was recorded on Fraps by Lysander, so it'll be a video podcast of sorts. I just thought I'd try something new, see how that goes. And I'll probably do something like this again in the future, but of course I'll talk about all that next week. I wanted to also mention something about this episode for this week. It marks a very special occasion for Guildcast, and that's the 1-year anniversary of Lady Sinea joining the show. She's been a great co-host, and I'm very thankful that she came aboard and stuck with me for all this time. So until next time, you can, of course, email me at sean@guildcast.com. That's SHAWN@guildcast.com. You can email Lady Sinea at LadySinaea@gmail.com. And now you can email Jenna at JENNA@guildcast.com. And as always, be sure to tell your friends and tell your guildmates about guildcast.com.